The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed.
Everybody's smoking, no one's getting high. Everybody's flying, never touch the sky. There's UFOs over New York, and I ain't too surprised.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Source for UFO information with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Been a lot of talk about credible witnesses over the years and how there seems to be a lack of them. And certainly in the last two or three years, many brave souls have stepped forward and said, hey, this happened to me in the past. Many of them military, many of them Air Force, as is our guest. Bob Jacobs received his B.A. from the University of Southern California and his M.A. from the University of California, Santa Barbara, where he went on to receive his Ph.D. in 1977. He instructs and advises radio and television majors. His creative focus is concerned with audio and video production. He teaches at a university in Illinois. We welcome Professor Robert Jacobs to the program. Bob, good evening.
Hi, Earl. How you doing?
Good, sir. And yourself?
I'm fine. I'm sitting out here on my farm 35 miles from the nearest town watching the stars and the coyotes run by.
Coyotes?
A pack of coyotes out that run around terrorizing the neighbor's cows, and they've just terrorized my two basset hounds as well.
The reason that you're with us tonight, Bob, is that you were with the United States Air Force back before you went back to university. You were a lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
You were officer in charge of photo-optical instrumentation at Vandenberg Air Force Base.
1369th Photographic Squadron was the unit I was assigned to, yeah.
What kind of stuff did you get into while you were with that squadron?
Well, all kinds of wonderful things. I was the first photographic officer in the Air Force to be awarded the guided missile insignia, for one thing, which was a highly coveted device that I'm holding in my hand right now. It's a little rusty, but it was a big deal back then.
And what does that mean exactly?
The people who got the guided missile insignia were awarded such for, quote, a significant contribution to America's missile and space program, unquote.
Mm.
Part of the documentation for it. Anyhow, I was involved in instrumentation photography of all the launches from Vandenberg down the Western Test Range, specifically ballistic missiles. We were flying birds to Aniwetok and Kwajalein, where we were testing such things as anti-missile systems, the Nike Zeus system people might remember from way back then, and other things. And I suppose your listeners are primarily interested in my UFO experience there.
Oh, you had a UFO experience, Bob?
I did.
You certainly did, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Take us back to that particular experience. It was a unique occasion in more than one way, because you had some new technology delivered to you, right?
It came about in a seemingly innocent way. The 1st Strategic Aerospace Division called us up. They were one of the clients that we served on base, and said the engineers needed to get a look at missile flight from a side angle. And they thought that perhaps if we went up the coast of California, if you can imagine a map of California, Big Sur is a big projection that sticks out into the Pacific Ocean, south of San Francisco, around to, and south of Monterey Bay. From there, there are some mountain peaks that sort of cascade into the sea. We went up and explored with the Forest Service and found a peak called Anderson Peak, which was about 4,500 feet in elevation and about 186 miles as the crow flies from Vandenberg. So I went up there with a camera crew just to test to see if we could possibly see missiles that were launched from Vandenberg. And because from Big Sur, Vandenberg is east, so as the missiles went due west, we should be able to see them in flight and see all three stages of powered flight, which is what the engineers said they wanted to see.
Mm-hmm.
So we went up there with a tracking mount and shot a test. And sure enough, as the missile took off, we were able to see first, second, and third stages of powered flight. And then we were able to see the payload as it disappeared off into the distance. So they were all quite thrilled about that and said, gee, now we can, instead of looking up the stovepipe, which is what we were doing at Vandenberg, we can now see all three stages and see what's happening.
Right.
After that little test, which occurred in March or April of 1964, the next thing that happened is the man I was working with at First Strategic Aerospace Division, whose name was Florence J. Mansman, he was a major at that time, he's now deceased, he called up and said that we had a special device coming out from Patrick Air Force Base. It's called the BU Telescope, standing for Boston University. It was designed by a guy named Dr. Walter Manning, and it came out in a large transport aircraft, and we hauled it up to the site on Anderson Peak with an 18-wheel truck. It was that large. It was a very large catadioptric telescope with an effective focal length, believe it or not, of 2,500 inches. That might not mean a lot to people who aren't photographers, but if you imagine a standard 35-millimeter camera has a focal length of 2 inches or 50 millimeters, then a telescope with an effective focal length of 2,500 inches is a very large telescope indeed. So they hauled it up to the site, and on a given day, and I must say that I'm not exactly sure about the date because of the secrecy that was attached to this whole nonsense, but the best I can recall was September 22nd, 1964, when the event occurred. There was a Mr. Paulson from Patrick Air Force Base and Florence J. Major Mansman, who later became my friend and whom I called Sonny. So if I refer to Sonny, I'm referring to Major Mansman. Sonny was on the site, and our crew, consisting of four or five of my enlisted guys from Vandenberg, were up there, and two operators of this telescope system. Now, the telescope had a, remember, this was in 1964. We didn't have color stuff, and we didn't have lasers, and we didn't have all kinds of things that we have today. We didn't have video enhancement. What we had was a kinescope recording from a television screen with an image orthicon tube on it attached to the telescope. The image orthicon tube was there so that we could reverse polarity so that the sky would be black and the image that we were photographing would be white. We're talking about a black and white image.
Mm-hmm.
So we hooked up a 35-millimeter camera to record that kinescope, and we had, of course, closed that off, so none of us could see the screen while we were photographing. It was around dawn. The sky was light when the rocket took off. It was an Atlas F or an Atlas D. Again, I'm not positive because of security clearance here on this thing, but it was an Atlas rocket with a dummy atomic warhead in it. I want to emphasize dummy. This warhead was the size and shape and weight of a real atomic warhead, but it didn't have any atomic payload in it. It was just a test. And the thing we were testing, as it turned out, was radar chaff. This thing was supposed to fly down and somewhere over Kwajalein, where they were attempting to shoot at it with a Nike missile. It was to release some radar chaff, which consisted simply of strips of aluminum foil about 18 to 24 inches long. And the nose cone would open, the chaff would deploy, and there was a small rocket motor attached to the dummy warhead, which went off and injected the dummy warhead into a slightly elevated orbit. So that what we were playing with here, and I emphasize the word playing dangerously, was the Russians would send their anti-missile missiles at the radar chaff, and our dummy warhead would successfully obliterate Moscow. That's the game we were playing. So we saw, with our standard camera, which had a 150-inch lens on it, the rocket come up out of the ground fog over the Pacific Ocean, and I shouted out, "There it is!" And the BU telescope swung around and locked in on it, and we watched all three stages of powered flight. First section dropped away, the second section, third section, and the dummy warhead sailed on into oblivion as our film rolled on the back of the BU telescope. End of story. Nothing strange there, is there?
No.
The next day, Vandenberg Air Force Base, after we had processed the film and delivered it, we were all quite pleased with ourselves that we'd been able to photograph all three stages of the powered flight of a missile. Major Mansman called me into his office, and as I went in, I remember two guys in gray suits, civilian suits, and Major Mansman, and a film projector and a screen. Major Mansman said, "Sit down, Bob." He didn't call me Bob. He called me Lieutenant Jacobs. So the lights dimmed, the projector fired up, and the film came on, and there, coming out of the fog, was the missile that we had photographed from 186 miles away, and the bottom one-third of that rocket filled the frame from that distance, so it was an enormously big image, and I was pretty tickled. The telescope locked on, as you accurately pointed out, by radar, and it locked onto the thing, and we watched the first stage burn out, and the second stage burn out, and the third stage burn out, and we watched a smaller image now as the nose cone separated and opened up. We watched the radar chaff deploy, on screen. I thought, wow, this is amazing, amazing photography. This thing is now traveling at 8 or 9,000 miles an hour, heading for Annie Weetok, and we're watching huge images of it. The radar chaff deployed, the dummy nuclear warhead was plainly visible at this point, and this whole package is flying along now at, as I said, 8 or 9,000 miles an hour by this point. When suddenly, and you have to try to grasp an image of this on a TV screen, suddenly from the left-hand side of the screen, that is the direction in which the missile was traveling, something else flew into the frame. And the something else was circular. It looked like two inverted pie tins stuck together with a golf ball on top of it. The best I can describe it. This thing flew in following our dummy package and fired a beam of light, which struck the dummy warhead. This thing then flew up over on top of the warhead, hit it again with another beam of light, flew off toward the right-hand side of the screen. It's doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead, continued its arc, came underneath it, and fired a fourth beam of light, then came back 360 degrees and flew back out of the frame in the same direction it had come.
And what speed is this warhead traveling that this thing is flying around and
it's
around?
It's going 8 or 9,000 miles an hour by this point.
8 or 9,000 miles an hour.
And accelerating.
So this thing is not only flying along at 8,000 miles an hour, but is exceeding that because it's whipping around and around this warhead.
It's doing loops around it, exactly. It's literally flying circles around it.
Hmm.
It's as if somebody's saying, yeah, look what I can do.
Okay, just for the sake of argument here, Dave Furlot here, by the way.
Hi there.
Was there anything in either the U.S. Air Force or the Soviet Air Force that could possibly do that you were aware of?
I can assure you there was nothing in the United States Air Force that could have done that. This was 1964, so relatively confident, based on our understanding of the Soviet space program, they had nothing that could do that either.
Exactly. Thank you.
What was the expression on your face when that film stopped rolling?
The film stopped rolling, the lights came on, and the guys in the gray suits were looking at me, and Major Mansman was looking at me. And Major Mansman said, "Lieutenant Jacobs, what do you think that was?" And I said, "It looks to me like we got a UFO." Major Mansman then said to me, "Were you guys in any way screwing around up there?"
Wow.
I don't know how we could screw around and do that.
At 8,000 miles an hour.
Yeah. So, no, we weren't screwing around up there, I assure you. He then said to me, while these two civilian guys stood there and watched, he said, "Lieutenant Jacobs, you are to say nothing about this. In fact, as far as you're concerned, this never happened." And I caught my breath, having just witnessed the most astonishing thing I had ever seen. An exhibition of something that changed my entire way of thinking about the universe, about mankind, about planet Earth, about so many things. And he said, "Now, I don't need to remind you of a severity of security breach, do I?" And I said, "No, sir." And he said, "Fine, you're dismissed." And as I walked toward the door, he came up and said sotto voce in my ear, that is, quietly in my ear, apparently so these guys in the gray suits wouldn't hear. He said, "Bob, if anything ever comes up in the future where you're cornered and you just have to say something, say it was laser tracking." And he escorted me out the door.
Say it was laser?
Say it was laser tracking.
Tracking.
We didn't have laser tracking in 1964.
But yet he used that word.
He used that word.
So he must have known something that a lot of other people didn't know anything about.
Sonny Mansman knew a lot of things that nobody knew a lot of things about. And I've got some letters from him where he indicates to me some rather serious things he knew about. And ended up getting a PhD in physics and was a consultant at Stanford and was involved in some very high-level stuff. 18 years went by. I didn't say anything to anybody, not my wife, not my friends, not anybody I worked with. I just didn't say anything. I lived in Northern California, and I was, in fact, hosting a late-night talk show, Errol, where I was BJ the DJ.
Well, and it's better than Boss Cat Bruce.
Anyhow, as you know, these things come up, and somebody late night, 1 o'clock in the morning, called up and started talking about UFOs, and I thought, what the hell? I've kept quiet for 18 years, and you know what? The guy didn't say this is classified top secret, because there are things that I was told are top secret that I wouldn't talk about, even now, because I was told, this is top secret, you may not talk about it. He said, this never happened. So I thought, well, heck. I might as well tell people about my little story, and that was the first time I told the story.
Back in, 1982 now, huh?
Around there, yeah.
Around there.
Take us back for a minute, Bob, to that meeting that you had with Major Mansman and those two other fellows that were sitting there with you in the room.
Mm-hmm.
So you can give our listeners a sense of what it was like trying to figure out who these people were, or what they said, how they looked at you, just the whole interaction of that meeting, because it's something that, as many times as I do watch your testimony on the disclosure tape and even on the sightings interview, the way you say it is very chilling, and your whole presentation is extremely authentic, and just your recounting of that would be fascinating for the listeners.
In the first place, I'm a pretty straight shooter, and at the time of this incident, I didn't believe in UFOs or ghosts or Santa Claus, and they were all sort of the same thing in my mind until I saw one for myself on film. I'm called by Major Mansman to the office to look at some film, which is a normal course of events thing that we've done 100 times, and I go up in my normal cheerful state, sit down, ready to look at some film, and here are these guys in gray suits staring at me. Now, nobody bothered to introduce them. Nobody said, "Hi, this is Chuck and Dave from Chuck and Dave's Pizza Parlor," or whatever. They were just simply not introduced, but they stood there looking at me. Major Mansman was, he and I were fairly close, I mean, as a superior officer and a junior officer can be under those circumstances. We were friendly, and he was, as we said in those days, uptight when I walked in. He wasn't his usual jovial, outgoing self. When the film ran, I was highly excited watching it, as who wouldn't be? In the first place, it was a thrilling confirmation of our test, of our sight, of the telescope, of the guys I worked with. It was a wonderful moment that we had captured this thing, and suddenly to find that we had also captured a UFO firing some kind of apparent weapon at our dummy warhead. I remember exactly where I was and what I had on and what I had in my hand and what the guy across the desk from me had and was doing when we heard the news that John F. Kennedy had been shot. I remember that as clearly as the day it happened. I have the same recollection of the day I walked into Mansman's office at First Stratad and sat down to watch that film. I can see the film in my mind every time I think about it. It changed my life. It changed the way I look at things. I don't care what anybody says at this point. And when Errol asked me to be on the show and tell my story again, I said, okay, sure. Knowing that some people will say, oh, this is another bull story, or oh, this is a load of crap, or whatever. I'm just telling my story as it happened to me, because it happened to me. I'm a living testimony, and I'm one of the few left living. I'm 64 years old now. Sonny Mansman is dead. Several of the people who were involved on this thing are now gone. John Andrews, a good friend of mine from the Tester Corporation, who was a great researcher in this field, is gone. So I'm one of the last guys about this incident saying, hey, folks, it happened. I saw it. It wasn't fake. It wasn't animation. It wasn't something Walt Disney produced. We shot it, and it was a UFO. I've tried to puzzle out in my mind for years now what it might have been. And as a researcher, I have a PhD, which means I've demonstrated to the University of California that I know how to conduct original research, and I've researched this subject rather thoroughly. I'm convinced that what I saw in that film, and through some letters from Sonny Mansman over the years, and a couple of other researchers, but mainly from Sonny, telling me that it was true, we photographed an intelligently controlled vehicle of some kind from some place or some when. Sonny's last correspondence with me in 1993, which was the last letter I had from him, indicated that he was investigating with other people other dimensions, which you can now read about in Scientific American and Discover Magazine. We're beginning to talk about parallel dimensions and so forth. And that what we might be seeing are intersections of parallel universes. In other words, it may not be coming from somewhere, it may be coming from some when. Another possibility that comes to my mind is that, of course, the simple solution is, well, it's an intelligent society from another star system. It's certainly not from our star system. So it's from somewhere else. And people say, well, how can things travel faster than the speed of light? That's impossible, Bob. The nearest star system is Alpha Centauri. If we were dealing, for example, with a civilization that was only 10,000 years in advance of ours, think how magical their science would be. Think how magical our science would be to people on this planet only 200 years ago. Television, radio, rockets to the moon, that's all magic. So when people say, well, it couldn't possibly be from another star system, I say, well, you don't know anything, you're just dumb. Of course it could be from another star system. Why couldn't it be? fact is that we're photographing something, and good people are seeing something, and agencies of the government, your government and my government, are covering it up. I know we were covering it up because I was ordered to be part of a cover-up by Major Florence J. Mansman, who said, you are to speak nothing about this, you are to say it never happened.
What was the result of your coming out in 1982 and talking about this incident that your camera and telescope recorded back in September of 1964? When you started to talk about it, what happened?
Some very colorful events happened. I started getting telephone calls late at night. I'd pick up the phone and voices would shout obscenities at me. They would scream, you're going down, quote unquote. They would say rude and unequivocal things about my wife and hang up. They were so blatant about this that I had an answering machine. They would call up and leave threatening messages on my answering machine. One night I was sitting in my living room. It was about 1 o'clock in the morning, and my mailbox blew up. Somebody put a bomb in my mailbox in Wisconsin that night. And within a matter of half an hour, there was a telephone call, and I have it on tape still today, that said, rockets in the mailbox at night. Oh, what a beautiful sight. You're going down, mother. So I had that happen to me for 3 or 4 years, those calls went on, even after I moved out of Wisconsin. A twit named Philip J. Class, who's a famous debunker of UFOs.
Oh, we've talked about him once or twice on this program.
I'm certain you have. Phil Class got on my case and helped get me fired from the University of Maine by writing letters, obscene, outrageous letters, accusing me of unethical conduct as a professor of journalism and so forth, which helped fuel the fires of having me lose my job at the University of Maine, which is why I'm a little canny now about telling people exactly where I live or exactly where I teach, although it's easy to find out if you're terribly interested.
Wasn't there some form of denial about the
Yeah, there was a researcher named Lee Graham, bless his heart, in Southern California, who was the first to get on the case and try to track it down. And he's an honest researcher. I believe he's still alive. He contacted the Air Force, filing a Freedom of Information Act, trying to get at the film, which, according to Sonny Mansman's letter to me, is impossible because those guys in the gray suits clipped off the piece of film. Remember, it was at the end of the reel. They clipped off the piece of film that had the incident on it, put it in a separate can, gave Sonny back the other film and said, here, you can have this, and Sonny signed off on that piece of film, which left the office and was never seen again. At any rate, Lee Graham tried to track this story down, and he contacted the Air Force. First of all, the Air Force denied that there was ever a First Lieutenant Robert M. Jacobs in the Air Force, so I provided documentation from my DD-214 to Lee to say, yeah, I was, and here's the proof. Then they denied that I had ever worked at the 1369th Photo Squadron at Vandenberg, so I dug up some orders to prove that I had been there. They denied that there was a tracking site at Big Sur, which is the most absurd denial of all, because whenever you see a landing of the space shuttle that happens to be photographed from California, guess where it's shot from? Anderson Peak at Big Sur, California, where I established that tracking site. So there was a whole incredible series of denials. They denied that an Atlas F was ever launched in September, or October, or November for that matter. Or if an Atlas F was launched, well, maybe an Atlas D was launched. It was an incredible trail of denial by the Air Force that I existed, that I had ever been at that job, that there was a tracking site at Big Sur, that there was any film ever shot, and so on and so forth.
There was also denial about the existence of the BU telescope being there?
That's correct. It was never there.
Oh.
I have film of it there, which I turned over to the people from Sightings who did a piece about this story.
That's where we first came across you. It was on the Sightings program.
Yeah. You saw the airplane that brought the telescope in. You saw the telescope going up the hill at Big Sur. You saw the tracking site at Big Sur. The Air Force denied it was ever there.
Yeah, implausible deniability.
Between 1964 and 82, when you actually came out and told your story there, did anything happen further with this particular incident?
No.
No? So there was no contact with anybody? Or
no contact with anybody? No. Not at all until the National Enquirer article came out.
Gotcha.
Here's a letter from Sonny Mansman to a guy named Peter Bonds, who's a UFO researcher. Dated March 8th, 1983, Peter Bonds had written to Mansman trying to verify my story. I'll just read it to you. Quote, so Dr. Bob opened a Pandora's box, and in the last few months I've been bombarded with phone calls and letters. I try to answer the sincere ones. First, the Enquirer story was true, except the date was 1964. I was in Vietnam in 65. Telescopic photography of that magnitude makes sizes undeterminable. We knew the missile size but could not compare since we didn't know how far from the missile the object was at the time of beam release. Maneuverability was also at question for the same reason. Propulsion was plasma-like. In such gravity, plasma-induced speed and maneuverability would not seem possible. But from clarity, action, and situation in the film, the assumption was at that time extraterrestrial.
And that answered an email question, which was how large the saucer was in relation to the missile, as far as you could recall.
It was impossible to tell.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, from the film, the warhead and the object, for want of a better word, looked to me to be about the same size. But as Sonny points out, it was impossible to tell. We didn't know how far from the object, from the warhead, the missile was. It was impossible to tell because we couldn't triangulate it.
The particular beam that you saw shot at the warhead itself, was this something that traveled from the ship? Did it actually have a path, just like a burst of light, like a light coming on?
Yes, it traveled.
You could actually see it traveling out from the,
let's call it a saucer. Let me read you once again from Sonny Mansman, because he had the opportunity to look at it with a magnifying glass, and here's what he wrote about it. The details would be sketchy, and from memory, the shape was classic disc. The center seemed to be a raised bubble. Not sure any ports or slits could be seen, but was stationary and moving slightly, floating over the entire lower saucer shape, which was glowing and seemed to be rotating slowly. At the point of beam release, if it was a beam, it, the object, turned like an object required to be in a position to fire from a platform. But again, this could be my own assumption from being in aerial combat. Remember, this is Major Mansman writing. He was a fighter pilot. There's one thing going on which may bring more to light soon. Howard University is into computer scanning for extraterrestrial signals from worldwide information gathered from amounts of data, good scientific data, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah, that does. That does very well.
Pretty much does it, yeah.
You said that you generally thought of that beam as a weapon. Was there any actual explosive force noticed in the
film? There was nothing explosive, but the dummy warhead tumbled out of orbit and fell into the ocean.
Ah, gotcha. Okay, good.
Missed its target. Did not go where it was supposed to go.
So if the rocket did get hit by the beam and then eventually found its way into the ocean, was there any kind of retrieval mechanism or procedure brought to bear on this? Did this rocket get recovered in some way, possibly analyzed?
Not to my knowledge, no.
That would be interesting to find out.
It was targeted for Aniwetok Lagoon. That's where most of the missiles from Vandenberg are targeted. Mm. It's like a big bullseye out in the South Pacific. And I've been down there a couple of times as well, watching them re-enter.
Mm.
If it fell short of that, it would be in water so deep it would be unrecoverable, probably, and besides which, we have no idea where it fell.
So for all we know, it's still there.
Probably.
What you were looking at on the film was the rocket ascending or climbing, huh?
What we were looking at on the film was the rocket leaving Vandenberg and heading for Aniwetok.
Mm.
Remember, there are three stages of powered flight.
Yeah.
First stage dropped away, the second stage dropped away, and the third stage fired, and then it dropped away, and we were following the warhead, the dummy warhead in the nose cone.
Bob, I want to thank you a lot for joining us tonight, and thank you for coming out and telling your story, and I hope that you get to tell it in front of a Senate committee soon.
Well, the truth should be told, and as Sonny Mansman said in his last letter to me, we are not alone.
Yeah, well, it certainly seems like that, doesn't it? Good night, Bob.
Good night, guys.
Good night.
Good night, Bob.
Good night.
Victor Vigiani, Dave Furlot.
Strange days indeed will continue with Errol Bruce Knapp on UFO News Radio, CFRB 1010.